pati pati saham pati katanjali anadivaram ayachata sandita satvaparaja kajatika desetu dhammam anukampimam pajam.
Very nice. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassami. I very much enjoy coming to the Peterborough group. It's one of the most warm-hearted groups I know, and most Buddhist groups are warm-hearted, so there's something very special about your group where you have this deep sense of caring for each other, and then I certainly feel that when I come here. So thank you for inviting me. But next year, next year I wanted to kind of give myself a bit of space, so I canceled a bunch of retreats. I've got an invitation to visit India with Lompo Sumedho, and I'd like to do some canoeing. So the time I can be away from the monastery is limited, because I obviously need to be at the monastery to cover my duties there. So I tend to get my year filled up with lots of teaching engagements, and then I thought I'd explore other things, have a few vacations or something. But I shall be back. I just thought next year do a bit more, do a little less teaching. Does anyone have any questions around some of the stuff that I've been saying before I launch forth some of the ideas? Yes.
Are you going to lead any retreats next
week? I'm just doing one. Well, I'm doing the one in Arnprior. I think it's September next year.
Okay.
Otherwise, I might be doing one in Singapore, if you want to come. Strange. I canceled the Latvian one and the Hockley Valley. I have these exotic places I go to. But the places I go to, though, people don't think it's exotic. So if there are no questions...
Oh, I have a question.
Yeah, please, yeah.
I
Tony?
I was wondering, when I was sitting here in meditation, and I was trying to, I was sitting here trying to be here by following my breath and where my body touched the mat, and then like something from the past would come up and it would enter my mind, and then I would anticipate like having an ice cream cone on my home sort of thing, and then I thought, well, does included all mean that you include when you're here and when you're not here? It's just like that's the way it is.
Yeah, and the not here gets less and less, because you are coming from a place where you're no longer needing sense experience, because the knowing of change becomes a very attractive, peaceful, desirable option. And as your mind settles into that, the need to the interest in, more like the interest in changing conditions like thoughts and fantasies, that becomes less and less attractive, and more and more just a kind of habit that you notice coming up. So the idea of like object meditation or any kind of meditation is basically to get the mind happy in some kind of peaceful way, so that you are content with being here, and that the need for compensations and such like is much, much, much less. So then when these things come up, you are more the witness of flow of consciousness rather than being engrossed in the scenarios of that. So if you come back to it, it all belongs, and what that's undercutting the tendency to then try to anticipate thought so that you're not thinking, a kind of aversion to thought. So what you're dropping into the mind all the time, as soon as you awaken, is wholesomeness. And metta is wholesome. And so you just keep putting in intentions constantly, which create a foundation for presence more and more and more and more. Yeah? That's the theory. Yeah, Susan?
You know, what you're saying, I've noticed that concentration does seem to lead to happiness. But I don't know, when I've done a long retreat, for example, and the mind gets very still, there is a joy that goes with that. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, yeah. A kind of settledness, which is quite satisfying.
And the idea is that then you eventually in your everyday life live in that place more and more?
Yeah, and also, like, the settledness then allows you to see how in the flow of consciousness you tend to grasp objects and ideas and so on. You understand yourself better, and you understand yourself quicker, I'd say. So there's the facility to awaken becomes enhanced. The whole awakening to change becomes more wise, like you understand it more, and that begins to erode the karmic tendencies and habits which we were all kind of getting caught up into. They have less and less power, and as they have less and less power, you fuel them less and less. So the one of the words that I often mention is the word for attachment, upadana. And I've been using preoccupation on this retreat as a kind of alternative, but upadana means attachment, also means fuel. So if I am heedlessly preoccupied with worry, I create the conditions for more worry. I put more worry fuel on. But as my mind settles into a sense of what non-worry is, and I witness worry more as just a habit, karmic habit, then it certainly comes and goes, and I may get caught a bit by it, but I'm no longer really fueling it. And that brings happiness too. So the mind sort of processes and empties out and liberates old karmas coming through. So that extreme example I gave of last night was like, it was very, very powerful, but it certainly released a lot. Not that I did it deliberately, but because it was a powerful energy, but I didn't fuel it. Didn't attach to it. There was a tremendous sense of freedom afterwards, and that's the kind of happiness too that we get. The sort of happiness of, yeah, I didn't get caught by that one. You know that one. Whereas before you got caught by it, that kind of thing. So it's kind of working at many levels. A level of just appreciating stillness, being able to be still. The level of processing and not fueling old karmas.
Could you remind us of the example you gave last night? Because
I woke up one morning thinking, my God, what have I done? What have I got myself into? You know, it's like, oh gosh, I've married someone I don't like. That was the only analogy I could get. But I didn't believe it. Yeah, but it was surprisingly powerful. And so, like, being with things like a discomfort during a sitting creates the parami or character to be able to nail those when they come. So you've developed the word parami we have. Parami is the virtuous qualities. That would, in Buddhism, I would consider character. And the development of character in Buddhism is not just to be a good social being, but it's actually a foundation for liberation. So something like being able to be patient and attendant to physical discomfort, not reacting to it, remaining equanimous, then sets me up, gives me the character to be with something more extreme. So all the, like these sittings, you may not think that, you know, you're achieving huge, I hope you are achieving huge things, but it might seem just ho-hum, ordinary, where am I getting? But actually you're building a lot of part of me, just being with whatever's there. That plays out more and more in ordinary life. Excellent, yeah.
So from my experience, I was having some sadness, and in staying with it, I was noticing that it was hard, it was migrating a narrative about it.
Right.
So, and I guess that's personal experience, but I'm wondering with that sort of imply that I need to stabilize more, or because it was hard to stay with the sadness about it.
So yes. Yeah. I think that's natural. It's going to go to storyline, and you just kind of say, oh, yeah, storyline, you come back. I think it's always going to be part and parcel of strong emotional things, but you've got enough awareness that you don't really run with the storyline for that long. So just see it as part, the way I look at it is just, it's really one package, heart, thought, right? It's one kind of package, so that the thoughts, the storyline things, they're going to be a part of it. And the longevity of it is okay. I think that's the hard part, that it comes through us for long periods of time. And that is where the tanha, I would say, would come up. So craving comes up because it's unpleasant. We want to figure it out. We want to sort it out. We think you have to do something about it. And that either the resistance or whatever, that's hard to see. So I often contemplate, this is the way it is now, I feel the sadness, what do I want? Or what do I not want? And if I can make that conscious, I can see, well, I'd like this not to be there, or I'd like my personal history to be different, or whatever. And the more conscious you can get a hold of craving, which I've been saying like is resistance anticipation, right? The more you can be with sadness. But it'll be, you know, the thoughts will be there. You know, it's just part of one package, really. And then like it all belongs, like, you know, you play with it. It belongs fine. You want to be here for 20 years. You know, that's the kind of attitude. Yeah, fine, whatever. You're here the rest of my life. Come on, you know, that. And then when you say that, you think, well, I don't want this 20 years. Enough already. And then you see, oh yeah, there is resistance. Yeah, there is resistance. You can't play around with it like that. And then when you see, and those resistances are quite often hard to notice. And then our analytical minds and the way we engage it is to try to figure it out and do something about it. And that it's okay, just the way it is quite hard to come to. So like with me, with that morning when I woke up, it was okay to be with it, but I was very careful not to believe in it. The story, like the thoughts were there, but I also had enough presence to know, bullshit. You know, kind of, I'm not going to believe you. So there was a kind of strength there too. Was that recorded? Ooh, to you. Sometimes strong words are necessary, but I think the sincerity of wanting to understand, that's a beautiful quality. But there's nothing really to understand. A lot of it is just to endure. Unfortunately. And I just go back to Lompo Cha always just saying, you haven't developed your mind, Viradhamma. You just have to endure. Which wasn't much compensation, but it's true. I just had to endure the karma of whatever had happened to me. The way we sometimes take things like strong feelings of loss, and sadness. One of the nice Buddhist ways of making that conscious is to say, all beings who have lost something and feel sad, feel this way. You know, so you're taking this kind of personal loss and saying, yeah, all beings who have lost, who feel lost, who feel lack, feel this kind of sadness. And that opens you to compassion to the very sadness you're experiencing. Yeah. That's quite a beautiful kind of way of making it work. But be careful that, you know, any kind of activity around it very often is tainted with a desire to get rid of it. It's very hard to just be purely with something which is painful. So we devise strategies which can work, but sometimes they still have the taint of getting rid of it. Huh? So that's something you learn about. Anyone else? Susan.
Okay, more questions if anybody else does.
Go for it.
People have been saying to me, if something really bad happens, that there's always something good. Like, you know, you might go back 20 years later and say, oh, that was the best thing that ever happened, or something like that. And I can see that sometimes if, you know, like there's that saying, what doesn't kill me makes me stronger. Like,
if you don't die. Those are cultural cliches which have, like Ajahn Chah would say, it's true but it's not right, it's right but it's not true. They're not absolutes. They're reflections, aren't they? Like half glass, you know, half full, half empty. Actually, I like to be cynical. Don't give me that glass half full, man. You know, you can take it either way. So they're cultural things that we've used to try to accept the way things are, right? But they can be patronizing sometimes. You know, you have a huge loss and the other person doesn't. They say, this will make you stronger. So, not always, like you say, it kind of depends. So if they're used for reflection, then you see, oh yeah, I see what you're pointing to. But if they become absolutes, and that's when I say something is a method rather than a position, or something is a method rather than a conclusion, then you're always using reflective mind. And again, people who don't use the reflective mind, I don't think they get Buddhism. You know, they get Buddhist ideas, but they don't know how to implement them. And they lack that kind of flexibility. And I see that in our communities. Like monks who are very rigid about the Vinaya can be very diligent, but terribly hard to live with. It's really hard to live with. They just have such strong opinions about what the discipline is. And you kind of... And they're always right. But they're never happy. You know, they got chapter verse, this is how it should be, and you kind of... 2-year monk telling me what to do, great. You know, and it's that's the kind of non-mind which isn't reflected. But the reflected... So wisdom, I would say in Buddhism, is different than knowledge. And wisdom is an active, dynamic part of our intelligence which is able to see cause and effect, which is able to use a teaching as a mirror. That's dynamic. Whereas dogma, position taking, attachment to views and opinions, that's always very rigid, isn't it? And we come across those people in religious forms that are quite frightening sometimes, right? Or boring, you know, the two extremes.
And my other question is, I found it's a guided meditation that makes me, it's not Vipassana, but it makes me feel better. I feel happier when I do it.
Uh-huh.
So, but I don't know how much, I mean, I can see where it's concentration practice, so that's not a bad thing. But I'm wondering how, I mean, how much to balance that with just...
Do it lots.
Really?
Yeah, do it lots. If it makes you happy, do it lots. Right?
It's healthier than Prozac.
Don't know, I've never taken Prozac, so... But yeah, do it. And if you come across something that opens your heart and makes you, uplifts you, do it lots. Get good at it.
Okay.
Get really, really good at it. That's the idea of object meditations. That they're there, you know, you develop a particular skill around a particular way of doing it, and you can return to that. And you know, it's like a nice recipe for you. And then the rest of life will challenge you. You know, there'll be lots of times you can't do that. But your heart will have a kind of tone and ease and a place that you feel kind of happy with, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you're to find something that's very fortunate. You know, it's quite good. Now, having said that, sometimes when you come across a new meditation, there is the uplift of the new. So, of the novel, right? And novelty is always interesting. But once the novelty wears off, you have the same old, you know, stuff dealing with it. But if you can get past that, it's not just a novelty, it's something stronger in your character that's attracted to that, then take note of that. That's good. Yeah, then good. And pursue that, develop that, and explore that. It's really good. And all of us have different... You know, some people just don't like doing breath meditation. Some people do very well with it. It's more like to be able to settle the mind in a happy way or a good way, peaceful way.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, please.
I guess what I'm struggling with when I'm meditating is that I have sadness come up, but I have a storyline. And I can't separate the story from the feeling.
You don't have to separate it.
Or like I can't, I'm not feeling it in my body.
You're not at all?
A little bit, but not as...
A little bit, so it's mostly in thought.
Yeah, and so then I get kind of stuck in being preoccupied with the story.
With the story, right. Well, I would tend to do something extreme myself. I think if the story came up, I think I just start to do deep breathing. Just to sort of, and I'm just, this is my intuition thing, right? I think I just kind of just do deep breathing. Oh, well, here it is, okay. Now what if I just deep breathe for a while? I just get into the body in some kind of way. Not to get rid of it. That you don't want to do. You don't want to do any kind of exercise. If I do deep breathing, I'll get rid of the sadness. You don't want to go there and say, do deep breathing with the sadness. That's the companion, the body companion. And that would get you more into the body. You know, you'd just be more physical with it. Then let go of the deep breathing and then see, do you feel something in the body? But don't look for it. You don't look for it. And just try to keep, just notice, like to say sadness. And then see if that word, the mood of sad, like notice when you're not sad, say, you know, it's non-sadness, you know, the sun's shining, you're walking around feeling all right, or you have a nice meal, something like that, nonsense, notice the non part of it, and then when it comes up, oh, what's the difference now? It's a mood, right? So it might not have a strong physical feeling, but it is a mood, you know it's sad, and of course there's a story around it, and try to see, okay, like, contentment or, you know, just having a nice muffin with coffee, right? Something simple like that. It's just pleasant, nice people. And then see how it shifts. See, like, contrast is very important. I find contrast, like in photography, in art, contrast is important. Same with understanding the mind. And you understand the mind quite often through the movement from one phase to another. So if you, because I'm sure you're not sad 24/7.
No, only when I'm in my thoughts.
Only when you're in thoughts, okay. So
not only,
So like just walking around, just note non-sadness. And then see where the movement is of sadness coming in. Don't try to catch it. At some moment, oh, this is sadness. Sadness feels this way. And just kind of recognize it. And then it'll go off into the storyline. And then, oh yeah, but sadness feels this way. So you're kind of recognizing a mood of the mind. You're recognizing a non-mood of the mind. And what you're doing is you're developing a stronger sense of awareness rather than trying to sort out the sadness. Because I think one of the problems we have is we always try to sort out the sadness or whatever, and we can preoccupy it again.
Or even by labeling it as sadness if I'm not feeling it.
I'm sorry?
If I'm meditating and labeling my thoughts as like the past,
yeah,
I'm feeling them, then I can get preoccupied.
You can get preoccupied, okay. So so the labeling then takes you into thinking?
Yeah. Exactly.
Or trying to figure out a label?
Yeah.
Okay. Then I'd have a cup of coffee, I think. I try something. What I find is like, if there's something I'm not noticing, I do something quite obvious, like deep breathing or, you know, things like that, and just kind of get away from it, and it kind of, just do some deep breathing now, because I'm too preoccupied with it, trying to figure it out too much. Just do some pranayama for 10 minutes and then let go of the obvious and see what arises. And that way you get contrast too. So like with sleepiness, that's what I recommend. It's like a lot of people have dullness, it's a very strong hindrance. I mean, people are falling asleep, so I say do pranayama, stretch your spine, do it for 20 minutes of a 1 hour sitting maybe. And that's vigorous. And then let go, and then sleepiness is there again. But then at least you have a contrast. So contrast is very, very good. Or sometimes take the sadness and make it ridiculous. You know, let's say you've got some sad thoughts, and then grab them and think a sad thought deliberately, but not too long. But you know, think it deliberately, and then stop. So then you've noticed the sad thinking. Maybe it's gone on for 10 minutes or whatever, and then, oh wow, sad thinking. Then grab it and just think through, blah, 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 and then stop. So you're kind of becoming more and more aware of that as an object rather than you being the subject of it. But some kinds of moods are, you know, karmically they can be very, very strong. They have a kind of unfortunate persistence in them. For me it was fear and anxiety, very strong, persistent, inexplicable forces that kept coming up into my mind. So I had to be just very diligent. Storyline, back to the breath, or, you know, deep breathing, whatever, again and again and again. But the fact that you know it's there, it's good, isn't it? You know, you're aware of it, you're not just kind of compensating and distracting all the time. You're meditating, but it's difficult. Those are good things, you know, so you're getting some inkling around it. But in those kinds of strong karmic things, keep encouraging yourself, because it is discouraging. You know, you think, oh God, here it comes again, right? So just, yeah, but I'm doing it. I'm doing the work. I'm trying, you know, kind of. That's very, very helpful, kind of encouraging thoughts. Because it is hard work. Like they say, it's Theravada Buddhism is brain surgery without anesthesia.
Wanted to say thanks for explaining the duality here, because I've really found that to be kind of very helpful.
The two ways of taking
with
the teaching?
Conventional and flow of consciousness.
Okay.
For my situation, that's really opened a door. And I guess the other thing, just as an observation, when I got here, I had a lot of thoughts and they were coming up. I didn't feel anything. And then by now all I feel is pain. nothing comes up. So I don't know if this is an emptying process. In some way, you mentioned the example where you didn't see a person and you got to that very high level. And I don't know.
Well, the, what, you mean the fact that you're not thinking?
Yeah, you're just kind of focused on maybe discomfort or something, and you're trying to be with that.
Well, you're not making the causes for thought to arise anymore for these 2 days. So you're not planning any engineering projects and so on, right?
That's right.
So all that work, intentions, create thought, and then family interactions or whatever, that creates the cause. Those are the causes for thought now. But during these 2 days, you're not making any causes. You're just kind of back. Yeah, and so the mind settles down. In fact, like, a weekend retreat is more difficult than a 10-day retreat. Because you're actually kind of just settling the mind down by the third day, and then you're back to the world. Whereas normally, like a 7-day retreat or a 10-day retreat, you have the kind of benefit of wearing that stuff down, and your mind has a natural settledness. So that's quite natural. As for the pain, well, sometimes pain is just tension of trying too hard, so that you can investigate. Sometimes it's just that's what bodies do. But I would investigate, like, the very way you make effort. Is there anticipation in the effort? Is there the holding of the body in a particular way which has anticipation in, or resistance, either of those? And then see, because if you really are, like, totally in the present moment, the whole body relaxes. And even if you have pain, there's a kind of settledness in the body, you're really down into the body. But resistance and anticipation, just like the anticipation for the clock to ring, let's say your hip starts to hurt after 15 minutes, and you know it's going to be 45 minutes, anticipation and resistance. And then to actually notice those, it's quite, and the mind starts to create this sense of, oh my gosh, this is going to be a long time. So that becomes the practice. But having said that, if the pain is just so disturbing, stand up and do standing practice or something. Because you don't want to just always be grinding out with pain. That's not fun. You have to. So do feel free to change your posture. But there is a lesson in pain, obviously. You know, there is a lesson in attachment to bodily formation, and the whole thing about negative craving around bodily pain. So if you can say, okay, I'm going to learn about pain now, rather than I'm just going to sit through this damn pain until 45 minutes is up. I'm going to really learn about how pain affects and how it creates craving or a sense of self. And then it's an interesting exercise. But like my early sittings, they were mostly kind of just, I was very determined not to move. So there wasn't the wisdom of looking at pain. So I could, you know, I could do it through willpower. But I wasn't very happy. It was only when I started to say, well, okay, pain's here. What is the craving around pain? So I try to take the Four Noble Truths and apply it to just physical pain. And that's really a good lesson. And then I always give myself permission to move. I found, like, with Mr. Goenka's Maximum Determinations, did you ever do a Goenka retreat? Well, he has these retreats where you sweep through the body. You do Anapanasati 3 days, then you do sweeping for 6 days, and then you finally do metta. That's the formula, right? It's like McDonald's of Buddhism, is just kind of crank it out day in and day out. And I think most of it have done that. And I found that they have a kind of maximum determination, you will not move. And as soon as they said that, I got tense. I said, okay, you cannot move your posture for 1 hour. I'd immediately... I'd be like really tense. Just a suggestion that I can't move made me tense. But I learned about it. So those are the things to kind of look at. Like, you know, like if you put into your mind, I can't move, that'll make you tense. If you move all the time, that'll make you restless. So you try to explore pain. But in, you know, when we talk about like concentration practice, we talk about various things. We talk about the hindrances. So the hindrances are dullness and restlessness. So that's around energy. You know, where your energy can't settle, or it settles so much that you fall asleep. And then aversion and infatuation. So aversion to the body, aversion to thoughts, aversion to sounds, or infatuation, fantasizing, you know, going off all the time. And then doubt where the mind just is always thinking all the time. So those we call the hindrances. And then we have the jhana factors. And the jhana factors are initial and subsequent application of mind. We talk about vichara. So, you know, once you understand how to deal with the hindrances, then if you want to apply your attention to an object, you have to make the intention, and then you have to sustain the intention. That's initial and subsequent application of mind. That's how it's translated. And that's thought. You're going to do the breath. No, back to the breath. And those become less and less. As your mind settles on the object, you need to say less and less to yourself, because you're there. And the next two are called piti and sukha, which are translated as bliss and happiness. And I would say they refer to a deep physical relaxation and a deep mental relaxation. Both are a part of it. And the last one, ekagata, is one-pointedness in mind. And you could see that one-pointedness on the object, or one-pointedness in the present. And those are the ways that we talk about, formally, about concentration practices. So in terms of piti sukha, if the body has a lot of pain and you're resisting it, you know, it's something you have to somehow figure out. Either change your posture, or see if there's a kind of holding, around a kind of a trying, which has a lot of holding in it. So that the mind feels very relaxed and the body feels very, very relaxed. So that's why, like, I recommend that people learn how to do the lying meditation. Because, you know, you can, any discomfort you get there usually is quite negotiable or doable, right? And you can learn a lot from it. And then it's interesting, pain sometimes. Some retreats I get a lot of pain. There's no real rhyme or reason. Okay, well, a lot of pain, I'm gonna do endurance today. And then just developing barmy around that. But not hurting yourself. That's why I'm on a chair now. Any other thoughts while we're here? Yes?
Can you talk more about your experience with fear and anxiety?
Well, okay, so my first year as a monk, I said to someone I had no fear. Little did I know. And where my fear was really, it was covered by cynicism and self-disparagement and a certain amount of aggression. So then as those were inappropriate and fell away, I saw how much fear was there. And then, and as I often say, as a kid, I was afraid to answer the phone. Right? So I'd run away from the telephone. But I wasn't a coward. You know, I wasn't, like, I could do brave and crazy things, but there was a lot of fear. So where it comes from, I don't know. But there it was. And so where it began to manifest most strongly was when I was teaching. So, or when I was, whenever I had to lead the community. So, like at Chithurst, I was in charge of the work projects, and I didn't have a clue of building work. I had never done the name, you know, because I was a senior monk, they made me in charge of building work. So I'd go to these morning meetings, breakfast meetings, just petrified, really nervous, and then teaching. So it became this kind of way of making conscious fear, and it was terribly, awfully uncomfortable, and I don't think people realized how nervous I really was. But I inside, I mean, I got probably just be, pulled it off in some way, but inside it was very, very, very lots of apprehension and nervousness and what am I saying? And then afterwards, you know, all the. But I just took Ajahn Sumedho's suggestions and I just kind of developed a lot of body awareness and really kind of, you know, said, like, you've got to get to know fear. You've got to know it inside out, anxiety. And so I made it like a study, you know, like you study turtles or something. And I mean, it wasn't that easy, obviously, but that intention to study fear and know it as a visceral experience and as a mental experience, the insight I had around there was that I had to develop, I had to understand how compassion for fear was the way of understanding fear. And that's obvious, easy for me to say, but my real problem was the fear of the fear or the aversion to the fear, right? And that was so ingrained that I do all kinds of practices, but I really wasn't. You know, I do kind of compassion practice to try to kill the fear, basically, which is doesn't work. So I do things in order to get rid of the fear, and that took me a long time to see that my intention was not the understanding and welcoming of fear, it was the eradication of fear. And again, it's easy to say, but boy, it took me a long time to figure that out. But because I was in situations where fear was being triggered all the time, because I was a senior monk when basically because there was no one else. You know, that's how it worked in England. There was like four of us and one monk went off to another monastery. So when Ajahn Sumedho left, me or Ananda, we were senior monk, right? But we weren't very senior. So I just ended up in these social situations where I was supposed to know something and I felt I knew nothing. And then the fear just came up all the time, all the time, all the time. And I just started to, first of all, know it physically. So, and you know, it was very obvious. Just the smell of my sweat was fearful, right? And then the feeling in the guts and having to go to the toilet and in the heart. And I just began to focus on that more and more. Focus on that and breathe with that, get to know it physically. And then the like anticipation, I began like if I didn't be anticipating I have to give a talk or a retreat and I'd be reading books and making lists and like preparing talks and my mind would go blank and then I'd forget what I would prepare and I said, well, that's not working. And Ajahn Chah and Ajahn Sumedho said, don't prepare your talks. Go in cold, or, you know, go in frightened, whatever. Just don't prepare your talks. And that was really difficult to do. And so then I'd learn how to do that. And then I just watch the fear. And then Ajahn Sumedho said, well, just start talking. And I do. I said, today is Thursday. I mean, I just but all the time, what I was doing was I was allowing the karma of fear to become conscious, but I wasn't fueling it. And I didn't understand that so well then. I had the kind of faith in what Lopa Sumedho was encouraging me in. I was just like, I was thinking today, when did I teach my first retreat? And I think it was like 1983. And on that retreat, this is very much uncertain, Ajahn Sumedho invited me to join him on a retreat in Northumberland. Oh, great. Yeah, be with a master, sit on a retreat, 10-day retreat. Oh, this is going to be great. Halfway through the retreat, he gets called back to Chithurst. No. No. I had to teach the second half of the ritual. I was so afraid. I forgot the chanting. I forgot. I did the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. I didn't know what to do next. You know? Huh? The Nick said, you sit up there now. And then there was this very sort of difficult laywoman who wasn't a Buddhist. And she was sitting right in front of me, girlfriend of the organizer, and she says, "What are you doing there?" And I said, "I don't know, he left." I was really afraid, right? But it was the kind of fear which was just psychological. And I knew no one was going to chop my head off. They're going to feed me the next day. So logically, it was quite, you know, it was all right. It was like, and so just time and time again, I'd watch it and watch it. It took a long, you know, it took like maybe 15 years to wear it out. You know, it's a lot of talking. And then then I think it clear that, oh, right. And then I also would come up again. But I knew, you know, now if it comes up, I just know it pretty clear. Now it doesn't come up very much. Funerals, they get me. Funerals, I get kind of nervous again. But it's just the karma, you know, just the karma of this thing. So it was because it was, you know, it probably consumed 50% of my time, right? You know, in a day, probably 50% of my time was concerned about anticipation and anxiety, whatever. So, you know, the logic was, well, if I sort this one, I got 50% done. You know, it's true in that way. And so, you know, as like Susan was saying, I'm kind of grateful for it now. And that's not being patronizing or, you know, it's true. But I'm grateful I had the sort of teachers which allowed me to, and I'm grateful people were sitting through my talks and things like that. So I found that the strongest karmic formation, and that was the strongest one I've had, was also where I learned about like Four Noble Truths. Because I said, well, what is suffering here? Fear is suffering. Wait, that's not. The teaching doesn't say that the khandhas are suffering, it's the attachment to them. So what's attachment? What do they mean? Attachment to craving. What do they mean by that? And I'd watch. Not just until I'd watch, I'd say, ah, yeah, it's the not wanting of the fear that's the problem. So that gave me insights into the Four Noble Truths. And then with the cessation of craving, the cessation of craving. I was looking for the cessation of fear. That's what I wanted. That was my wanting mind. And I'd look again, well, it's the cessation of craving that the Buddha's pointing to. Ah, and I begin to say, oh yeah, it's the wanting, not the fear that's the problem. And I kept trying to differentiate that. And I say, well, fear is unpleasant, but the wanting, that I can begin to get a hold of. And then I began to say, oh, welcome the fear. And that was the cessation of the desire to get rid of the fear. And if I kept doing that, then the fear was still unpleasant, but it was more like the physical pain you have in the body but don't react to. It was more like that. And then it was all right. But the pattern of trying to get rid of the fear would keep returning again and again. Ah, it's the craving, not the fear. The fear is just karma. Some kind of karma coming through me. It's just the way it is. There's nothing wrong with it. And obviously I wasn't running with a storyline. You know, I mean, the storyline would kind of twitter away there, but the deeper commitment was to the body and to the very nature of fear. And then, you know, later on, I said, oh, great, fear's up. Come on, let's have it. Because I realized, yeah, this is purification. So something would trigger it. So, okay, cool, come on, let's have it. Let's have like 100 pounds. Yeah, because I knew that this is purification now. It wasn't just someone telling me it's purification. I knew, yeah, this is good. And so I had more and more sense of, yeah, it's all right. And yet I wouldn't follow the storyline. You know, that I was very strict with. Don't follow the storyline. But there wasn't the fear of the fear. There wasn't the fear of the fear. And it's like one of my gauges was airports. Now, if you're self-conscious, wear this outfit. I mean, it's like ridiculous outfit. I mean, I get more looks than the women, right? So, and so I, I, I'm a very self-conscious, frightened guy. And this outfit in an airport, you know, and everyone is looking at you, you know, like, well, you know, you think if you're paranoid, you just think people are looking at you, but me, they are looking at me. So I'd feel really self-conscious, and I would just walk into busy places in the airport, because what I wanted to do, well, sometimes I wouldn't, but I just wanted to go find a corner, like behind there, and then, no, I'd walk in where there are a lot of people and feel self-conscious. And, you know, it's a very awful feeling. Now I don't feel that. You know, I still look the same. But I suspect also I don't emit the vibration of fear, and people are much more respectful of me, I suspect. I don't look like a dog with a tail between his legs, right? So it was a perfect outfit for fear, self-consciousness. So I was just like, and I actually, you know, because it was like one kind of defilement, like again and again and again, it was actually sort of obvious to work with. Oh, there it is again. Oh, here it is again. And so I really gauge it now, airports, and it, like, coming from Thailand and Hong Kong and all that, it's no self-consciousness. And that's, you know, that's kind of what I was saying, the satisfaction of competence. You know, there's the competence in practice, and then there's the kind of results of that. And those are very real. They're not egotistical results, like, you know, I did this with my ego. They're dropping away, aren't they, rather than acquiring something through ego, aggrandissement kind of thing. The things that have dropped away through right practice. That's wonderful. Yeah, and so there's a freedom there which isn't dependent on objects. Whereas my peace was dependent on the solitude of my kuti. You know, I'd go to my kuti, oh, no fear, beyond fear. And get out of the kuti, and then something else would come up. Huh? So, if you know, I think a lot of people are not conscious of fear. You know, the persona kind of covers over a lot of fear. So I think if it's conscious, I think it has that value of purification, and just sort of saying, all right, kind of like the mind, this belongs to, that's that kind of attitude that I find helpful. I'll have to write a book on fear, I think.